This episode is provided by Thomas Allgaier and Frenis, based on the most relevant LinkedIn posts about ICT and tech insights from CW 27 and 28. Frenis supports ICT enterprises in the form of delivering precise ICT market and pricing intelligence that analysts' subscriptions and existing databases cannot provide. You can find more info in the description.
Absolutely.
So if you think about building a massive physical structure, right, like a skyscraper or a suspension bridge, the progress is just entirely obvious.
Oh, yeah, you literally see the steel beams going up.
Right. You look out the window, you see the concrete being poured. The scale of the project is, you know, it's tangible. But in enterprise technology, massive structural shifts usually happen completely invisibly.
Yeah, totally out of sight.
Exactly. They take place in lines of code or inside microscopic silicon structures or just deep within some locked server rack. You never actually see the steel going up. Until one day, you wake up,
yeah,
and the entire digital skyline has completely changed on you.
Which is pretty terrifying, because that leaves you operating your business in a city you fundamentally just don't understand anymore, simply because, you know, you weren't paying attention to the foundation being laid underground.
Yeah, and that invisible foundation is exactly why today's deep dive is tailored specifically for you. As digital transformation and tech professionals, you are the ones tasked with navigating this shifting landscape.
Somebody's got to do it, right?
Right. And we have gathered a stack of ground-level intelligence for this, insights straight from the engineers, the executives, and the policymakers who are actually building this new infrastructure. Our mission today is to just cut through all the vendor marketing hype and really connect the dots between theoretical physics and your day-to-day enterprise IT strategy.
It's a big jump, but we're going to get there.
We are. We're looking at three massive interlocking shifts. First, the sudden industrialization of quantum computing. Second, the geopolitical race for quantum-safe infrastructure. And finally, the immediate reality of AI-driven cybersecurity converging with sovereign edge networks.
I mean, it sounds like a lot of disparate domains, but the through line is actually incredibly tight. The theoretical is becoming physical, and the physical is, well, it's forcing a complete rewrite of enterprise governance.
Let's start with that transition from theoretical to physical, because for years, quantum computing has basically been viewed as a, you know, a distant science experiment.
Just a total someday technology.
Exactly. Happening in highly controlled bespoke labs. But looking at our sources, there is a sudden and frankly violent shift toward actual industrial scale deployment. Like, we are talking about pouring actual concrete.
We really are. Russell Shawn actually highlighted a fantastic example of this exact momentum. So Quantum is currently breaking ground in Moreton Bay, Australia.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. To build the world's first utility scale, fault tolerant quantum computing facility. It's this massive government backed infrastructure project. But, and this is key, what makes this project so crucial to the industry isn't just the size.
What is it then?
It's the manufacturing approach. They are utilizing existing semiconductor fabrication processes.
Oh, meaning they aren't trying to invent a completely new way to manufacture the chips from scratch.
Precisely. They are plugging right into the multi-billion dollar infrastructure the classical chip industry has, you know, already spent decades perfecting. That is the very definition of moving from a bespoke science project in a basement to structured, scalable manufacturing.
Let me push back for a second, though, because I think we need to clear up a massive misconception before we talk about utility scale quantum.
Sure. Yeah. Lay on me.
Whenever people hear about quantum computers, the prevailing myth is that it's just this giant magical machine that tries every possible answer to a problem simultaneously and then just spits out the correct one.
Oh, man, I am so thrilled you brought that up. It is easily the single most common misunderstanding in the space. Sanjay Vishwakarma actually addressed this exact confusion in his recent analysis. A quantum computer does not check every answer in parallel.
Right, because if it did, engineering one would actually be much simpler, wouldn't it?
Oh, infinitely simpler. Instead, it relies on two quantum phenomena, superposition and interference.
Okay, unpack that for us.
Sure. Think of it like dropping two pebbles into a perfectly still pond.
So the ripples kind of overlap and interact with each other.
Yes. And when they overlap, two things happen. In some places, the waves build on each other to create a larger wave that's constructive interference.
Makes sense.
In other places, the peak of one wave hits the trough of another, and they just cancel each other out completely, making the water flat. That is destructive interference. So a quantum computer essentially orchestrates the probabilities of a problem so that all the incorrect answers cancel each other out through that destructive interference.
Wow.
Yeah, it heavily biases the final measurement toward the useful information.
That's fascinating. And actually, Mohamed Ouida-Hassan shared a brilliant analogy for how that orchestration really works physically. He pointed out that classical computing is hardwired, much like a traditional music box.
Oh, I like that.
Right. The physical mechanism, the bumps on the little metal cylinder dictates the tune. The hardware is the software. But a quantum computer is fundamentally different. It is orchestrated.
The qubits themselves are just the instruments?
Exactly. The hardware doesn't change shapes. Instead, carefully engineered microwave pulses act as the conductor, telling the qubits how to interact and interfere with one another.
And that control mechanism, those microwave pulses, is where the real engineering magic happens. Classical is hardwired, quantum is orchestrated.
And what really stands out in our sources is how fast the orchestra is improving its performance. Like the error correction breakthroughs happening right now are staggering.
They really are.
Kristen Perez pointed out that NVIDIA's Ising decoding just delivered a 300 times improvement in logical error rates.
300 times. That's huge.
It's massive. And she also mentioned a 7 times decoding speedup for something called color codes. But, for the enterprise IT folks listening who aren't quantum physicists, how should we even understand a color code?
It's a great question. You can think of a color code sort of like a Sudoku puzzle. In a highly volatile quantum system, errors just happen constantly. Qubits lose their state. But instead of pausing the system to check every single qubit individually to see if it's correct,
Which would destroy the whole calculation, right?
exactly, you lose the quantum state entirely. So a color code maps the qubits onto a topological grid. The system just checks the patterns of the colors on the grid.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. If a pattern is out of place, the system instantly knows an error occurred and can fix it without ever looking at the underlying data. It is a highly efficient way to spot mistakes on the fly. And NVIDIA speeding that detection process up by a factor of 7, that is a massive leap towards stable systems.
And they aren't the only ones making those leaps. Yossi Matias noted that Google's Willow processor took a completely different approach.
What did they do?
They used a reinforcement learning agent to improve logical qubit stability by a factor of 3.5. So they're essentially training the system to continuously self-calibrate. It learns from its own errors in real time without being taken offline.
That's incredible. And then you have companies operating entirely at the software layer, like Seed IQ. Denise Holt highlighted how they're bypassing the theoretical timelines we all thought we were stuck with.
Also.
They are enabling hardware-agnostic, fault-tolerant quantum compute on third-party IBM quantum processing units today.
Wait, today.
Today. They do this by governing the full validity chain of the execution layer itself. So they aren't building the fridge, they are perfecting the conductor's baton, to use your analogy.
That brings up the obvious business question, right? What are we actually going to use this incredibly stable, fault-tolerant orchestra for? Because let's be honest, this isn't about making our enterprise ERP systems run a little faster.
Oh, far from it. Peter DeSantis, and he referenced foundational insights from Peter Shor here, explained the true utility of these systems lies in simulating chemistry and physics at a level classical computers simply cannot touch.
Right?
His prime example is simulating FMoco.
FMoco, the molecule at the heart of biological nitrogen fixation.
Exactly that one. The industrial process the world uses right now to create fertilizer, the Haber-Bosch process. It consumes massive amounts of global energy and emits staggering levels of CO2.
It's incredibly inefficient.
Completely. But nature, on the other hand, uses the FMoco molecule to fix nitrogen at room temperature with incredible efficiency. But that molecule is far too complex for a classical computer to accurately simulate. A quantum computer, though, could simulate that specific chemistry.
So it would allow us to just reverse engineer nature and create wildly cleaner, more efficient industrial processes.
Exactly.
And we are already seeing the first concrete steps toward that reality.
Where?
David QL highlighted a recent paper in Physical Review X Quantum that actually demonstrated an error-corrected H2 on H2 quantum chemistry workflow.
Wow.
Yeah. The science is officially crossing over into practical engineering,
Yeah.
and the public markets are moving in to test this maturity too. Jan Goetz and Cecile Ampereau observed IQM's recent NASDAQ listing.
Right, that was a big deal.
It serves as a major test case for how public markets evaluate European quantum companies. Investors are no longer just looking at R&D grants. They want to see system integration, manufacturing reliability, and, a clear path to commercial viability.
Which seamlessly transitions into our second major shift. Because this hardware is proving it can actually simulate complex molecular structures and, by extension, eventually break current mathematical encryption, It has graduated from a fascinating tech trend to something much more serious.
Because it works, it is now being treated as critical national infrastructure.
Exactly. Marcus Flisch referred to this as the quantum Sputnik moment. He pointed to two recent U.S. executive orders that explicitly connect quantum commercialization directly to national security.
They aren't messing around.
Not at all. The government isn't just funding research. They are mandating a transition to post-quantum cryptography, or PQC, across federal systems by 2030 and 2031.
So they are placing hard deadlines on the calendar. And they are throwing serious capital behind both the offensive and defensive capabilities. Paul Dabbar shared an update on the $2.013 billion in CHASE Act investments.
That's a lot of funding.
Yeah, a massive chunk of that includes a billion-dollar federal match given to IBM to build America's first commercial quantum chip foundry named Anduron up in Albany, New York.
However, tapping into government funds isn't the only way to build leverage in this space. Sisson Kim observed a really fascinating contrast. IonQ got $0 from that specific CHIPS package.
Oh, really? Zero?
Yep. But they didn't slow down. They're leveraging their own $3.1 billion balance sheet to vertically integrate their manufacturing processes. They're proving there are multiple, highly competitive pathways to out-execute rivals in this market.
And the defense sector clearly agrees. Christopher Akpala noted that Booz Allen recently secured a $25 million U.S. Air Force contract specifically dedicated to quantum research. So the immediate tactical defense relevance is already priced in.
Yeah, it is. But before we dive deeper into the defensive side of this equation, you know, the actual cryptography migration your enterprise needs to worry about, I think this is a good moment for a quick reminder.
Oh, yes. If you are finding this breakdown of the geopolitical tech race valuable, take a second to hit subscribe on The Deep Dive. It ensures you won't miss our future updates on how these massive structural shifts continue to unfold.
Highly recommend it.
Okay, so let's look at the defense. The post-quantum cryptography migration, and Anna Oswalt raised a major red flag regarding the harvest now, decrypt later threat.
This is the stuff that keeps CISOs up at night.
Seriously.
Yeah.
Threat actors are actively siphoning heavily encrypted data today. They're just sitting on it in massive storage arrays, waiting for a quantum computer powerful enough to crack the encryption 5 or 10 years from now.
Which is a catastrophic risk profile for any data with a long shelf life. We are talking about pharmaceutical intellectual property, long-term health records, weapon schematics, and national security secrets.
Right. Which makes Ben Volkel's recent point about governance so alarming. He noted that cryptography is deeply embedded everywhere in the modern enterprise, yet it is rarely governed centrally.
No one has a master list.
Exactly. You cannot replace an outdated algorithm if you don't even know which legacy applications are currently using it. That critical blind spot is why his company, QIZ Security, just raised $17 million specifically to help enterprises discover and manage their cryptographic posture before those 2030 deadlines hit.
And Michael Osborne added a really critical nuance to this entire quantum safe conversation. Being quantum safe isn't just about swapping out one algorithm for another.
It's more complex than that.
Way more complex. It requires a flawless implementation across multiple layers, the algorithms, the network protocols, the hardware products, and the cloud services.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a single classical breakable dependency anywhere in that implementation chain,
the whole thing falls apart.
The entire system is compromised.
Exactly. Let me introduce a heavy dose of reality here, though, courtesy of Dr. Chase Cunningham, because I think we need to balance this out. He looked at these sweeping government mandates and essentially asked, aren't we massively overreacting?
Fair question.
He pointed out a glaring engineering fact. The largest number Shor's algorithm has actually factored on real quantum hardware is the integer 35. Not a 35-bit number, the actual number 35.
Yeah, it is a profoundly necessary reality check.
He goes further, noting the thermodynamic hurdles. Breaking RSA encryption requires millions of physical qubits cooled to 20 millikelvin. To achieve those temperatures, you need a specific isotope called helium-3, which is primarily a byproduct of nuclear weapon decay.
Not exactly something you can buy in bulk.
Right. The global supply is incredibly constrained. We literally do not have enough of the physical gas on planet Earth to cool the millions of physical qubits required using our current architectures. Meanwhile, in the reality of today's enterprise, 88% of web breaches are just stolen credentials. Employees are clicking on phishing links, while boards are obsessing over a theoretical machine that requires thermodynamic miracles to function.
I mean, Cunningham is entirely correct about the immediate physical engineering hurdles. But Atom Labs offers the necessary synthesis to bridge these two viewpoints. Quantum computing does not need to be mainstream today to completely alter your date strategy today.
It comes down to the horizon of risk.
Precisely. Boards of directors don't need to understand the physics of superposition or the supply chain of helium-3. But they absolutely must understand their own cryptographic dependencies. It is fundamental risk management. You have to build crypto agility now, because untangling legacy encryption takes years.
So by the time the hardware actually catches up, whether that's in 5 years or 15, it will be far too late to start your migration. Which brings us perfectly to our final theme. While governments are stress testing their supply chains for a potential quantum threat in 2030, digital transformation leaders and CISOs are fighting actual fires today.
Yeah, the real world stuff.
Right. They are battling machine speed AI attacks right now and struggling to build the physical infrastructure to comply with massive looming regulations.
The pace of digital innovation has suddenly become a severe liability if your security posture cannot match it. Antonio Grasso made the point that attackers are already heavily utilizing AI automation to probe networks. Defensive AI agents are no longer a luxury. They are required to close that machine speed gap. You need them for continuous network monitoring and instant first response.
Leaving the human security teams to handle the actual judgment calls.
Exactly. The AI handles the sheer speed and volume of the initial attack, isolating the compromised nodes. The humans step in to handle the nuanced problems, you know, the legal exposure, the business continuity plans, and public relations.
But there is a massive disconnect on who actually owns that resilience process. Charles Hosner published some shocking research on this dynamic.
Oh, what did he find?
He found that 94% of CSOs believe their role extends beyond technical defense into enterprise resilience and crisis leadership.
Makes sense.
Right. But only 62% of CEOs agree with that assessment.
Oof.
Yeah, that is a massive leadership misalignment on what resilience actually means at the C-suite level.
And they need to resolve that misalignment quickly, because the regulatory hammer is already coming down. Clayton Inge highlighted the new Dutch cybersecurity law as a prime example. It hits 8,000 organizations by August 2026.
Wow, that's fast.
Yeah, and it requires strict board-level accountability and mandates a 24-hour incident reporting window.
I mean, think about what a CISO goes through at 24 hours. Just identifying the scope of a breach and briefing the legal team can take days. Demanding a report in 24 hours forces a total operational overhaul.
And this isn't isolated to the Netherlands either. Salvatore Cataldi and Andrei Prozorov discussed the European Cyber Resilience Act, or the CRA. It mandates that software maintenance, vulnerability handling, and supply chain transparency are now permanent, legally binding parts of product quality itself.
So you can't just build it and forget it.
No, supply chain transparency is essentially a nutrition label for your software. If an obscure open source library gets compromised, the CRA demands that you know instantly if your product uses it, and you are permanently on the hook for patching it. You can no longer just ship a digital product and walk away.
If I'm an enterprise leader looking at this landscape, I've got exploding AI workload demands, machine speed security threats, and these massive data residency regulations, I'm realizing I can't just hand my entire infrastructure over to a few centralized hyperscalers.
No, that won't work anymore.
I can't just build a bigger centralized data center. I have to push the compute outward. Is that what is driving this sudden intense focus on digital sovereignty?
That is the core driver, absolutely. David Soto Avenatas explained that edge computing and private 5G are becoming the operational foundation for resolving this bottleneck. They allow enterprises to scale their AI capabilities locally without ever losing control or residency of their own data.
I like to think of centralized cloud computing like a massive, congested central post office.
Okay, I like where this is going.
Right. Every time you need a stamp, you have to mail your letter all the way back to a mega warehouse in another state, which completely clogs the highways. Edge computing is like installing a hyper-intelligent automated mail sorter on every individual street corner. It processes the heavy lifting locally.
That analogy fits perfectly with what Kim Weiland highlighted regarding Azure Front Door Edge actions. Microsoft recently introduced serverless JavaScript execution directly at edge locations globally.
Serverless doesn't mean there are no servers, though, right?
No, it just means the code runs dynamically, wherever the user is located, without the developer managing the hardware. So if malicious traffic originates in Berlin, the security routing, the filtering, and the authentication all happen on a local edge node in Berlin.
Oh, that's smart.
Yeah, it stops the threat locally before the request even travels to a backend server.
It pushes lightweight, critical decision-making to the absolute perimeter of the network. And honestly, It is becoming a physical necessity, not just a software preference. Andreas Herden provided some incredibly stark context from Germany on this.
What's happening there?
Germany is attempting to quadruple its AI capacity by 2030. But doing that is exposing severe power grid and last-mile infrastructure bottlenecks.
Oh, the power demands are insane.
Right. You literally cannot build giant hyperscale data centers everywhere. The physical power grid cannot support the load. Distributed edge computing is a practical, physical necessity to bypass those grid constraints.
And managing all of this distributed architecture, you know, from local edge networks and AI security protocols to legacy IT systems, is incredibly complex. Jeff Winter noted that IT and OT convergence is currently a $720 billion structural business shift.
And just to clarify, OT being operational technology.
Yeah, the physical machines on a factory floor, the power grids, the HVAC systems. IT is the data layer. Merging a robotic assembly arm with a cloud database securely with zero latency, it's historically a nightmare because those two worlds were never designed to speak the same language. It is a massive structural shift, not a weekend IT project.
Which explains why enterprises are actively flocking to massive, trusted partners to manage the chaos rather than trying to build it all in-house.
Precisely. Elkin Dole and Christoph Chalons reported that T-Systems retained its number one spot in the German business ICT services market, holding a 13.7% market share alongside roughly 40% in telecom services.
People want stability right now.
The current market is incredibly cautious. Enterprises don't want experimental vendors right now. Companies like Accenture, Deutsche Telekom, and Capgemini are dominating across the EMEA regions specifically because they are successfully merging heavy telecommunications infrastructure with robust, secure IT services.
Right.
They are providing the clear business impact and trusted execution that enterprises desperately need to bridge that IT and OT divide.
This brings the entire picture together. We started off by talking about that invisible digital skyline, the technological foundation you cannot see being built. What we are really witnessing right now is enterprise technology stretching violently in two entirely opposite directions.
Yeah, it really is.
On one hand, it is diving incredibly deep, down to the subatomic level with orchestrated, fault-tolerant quantum computing designed to simulate reality itself.
And simultaneously, it is distributing outward as far as physically possible to the absolute edge of the network with private 5G and serverless edge action.
Exactly. The organizations that manage to thrive over the next decade will not just be the ones who write the checks to buy these tools. It will be the organizations that fundamentally rewire their internal cultures, their data governance, and their C-suite leadership alignment to remain agile across that entire massive spectrum.
The concrete is being poured right now.
It is officially time to learn the layout of the new city.
Well said.
If you enjoyed this episode, new episodes drop every 2 weeks. Also, check out our other editions on field marketing, channel and partner marketing, account-based marketing, MarTech, go-to-market, and social selling. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe.